I don't savor the prospect of negotiating a piece of legislation with this White House. If it ends up saving lives, I feel like I have an obligation to do it.
It clearly is a step forward.
It was just a horrific scene.
I think they are realistic. It's just a matter of when we're going to be able to get there. And that is going to take some time.
Hi, it's WAMC News Director Ian Pickus. On this episode of the WAMC News Podcast, a plane crashes into a house in New York's Hudson Valley. New York Governor Andrew Cuomo and State Comptroller Thomas DiNapoli agree on a pre-audit authority plan, and MGM Springfield marks its first anniversary. First, Connecticut U.S. Senator Chris Murphy has been a fierce critic of President Donald Trump, but following a conversation with the president, the Democrat says he's willing to work with the White House on a bill mandating background checks for firearm sales. Murphy and Trump spoke after mass shootings in Texas and Ohio restarted a gun control debate that defined Murphy's first months in the Senate following the 2012 massacre at Sandy Hook in Connecticut. Murphy spoke with WAMC's Alan Chartok on the Congressional Corner about the state of the talks.
I've been through, you know, this rodeo before. After the Parkland massacre, he invited a group of us over to the White House, let the TV cameras in, and in that meeting told myself and Dianne Feinstein and others that he was going to be supportive of background checks expansion, that he might even go further than that and support Senator Feinstein's bill to reimpose the ban on assault weapons. And then, as you mentioned, within about 24 hours, the NRA walked into his office and he did an about face. I talked to the president about 2 weeks ago. He called me when I was in Connecticut, and he told me that he was sincere this time about passing a bill to expand background checks. And he acknowledged that he didn't do what he said he was going to do after Parkland. So you know, we're working with the White House right now. We're hopeful that they will engage this week with us on a process to try to get a background checks bill expansion that we can support on both sides of the aisle. But yes, I remain skeptical that he will follow through. We'll see.
And what about Mitch McConnell? Do you ever talk to the guy?
I do. You know, in the end, you know, Mitch McConnell is not going to confront the President of the United States on this issue, especially when 90% of his members' constituents support universal background checks. If the President gets on board with a background checks proposal, Mitch McConnell is not going to stand in its way because he knows it's wildly politically popular and it would then have the support of the President. So this really is up to the White House. The White House can deliver a background checks bill that would make this country demonstrably safer, that would save thousands of lives. And as you said, you know, the precedent would tell us that ultimately the NRA is going to win out. They spent a lot of money to get Donald Trump elected, and they're going to remind him of that. But for the time being, my one and only conversation with the president was one in which he told me he was going to pass a background checks bill. And so I'm going to do my best over the next couple of weeks to try to hold him to that conversation.
Well, everybody knows he's a liar. I hate to say this to a United States senator who has to do business with the guy, but how can you ever trust him?
Well, like I said, I mean, he told us that he was going to pass a background checks bill after Parkland, and he didn't do that. And as you mentioned, it sounds like he's already, you know, starting to get a bit of cold feet on background checks. You know, what I know is that this is a life or death issue for people in Connecticut and across this country. And so while I have the president's attention, I'm going to try to hold it. I understand the president lies a lot, that he says a lot of things that he doesn't end up following through on. But on this commitment, I have to try to hold him to it because, you know, while I don't savor the prospect of negotiating a piece of legislation with this White House, if it ends up saving lives, I feel like I have an obligation to do it.
Again, that's Connecticut U.S. Senator Chris Murphy speaking with WAMC's Alan Chartok. A small plane crashed into a house near Poughkeepsie over the weekend, causing a massive fire and leaving the pilot and one of the residents dead. Now, there's a fundraiser for the displaced family, and Dutchess County officials are helping a number of those involved address the trauma. More now from WAMC's Hudson Valley Bureau Chief Allison Dunn.
State police on Sunday tentatively identified those involved in the plane crash on South Smith Road in Unionvale. The aircraft pilot was identified as 61-year-old Francisco Nipping Diaz of Woodmere on Long Island in Nassau County. His two passengers were identified as 50-year-old Eduardo Tio, also of Woodmere, and 52-year-old Teofilo Antonio Diaz Prat of the Dominican Republic, both of whom sustained non-life-threatening injuries. Police say 61-year-old Gerald Bacher, who was home at the time of the crash, has been tentatively identified pending information at autopsy. Bacher's 21-year-old daughter, Hannah, was critically injured, and 30-year-old daughter, Sarah, sustained non-life-threatening injuries. Neighbors told the Poughkeepsie Journal that the Bachers had lived in the house for 30 years and that Gerald Bacher's wife was not home at the time, and they have a son in California. Dutchess County Executive Mark Molinaro was on scene Saturday.
It was just a horrific scene that no person could possibly anticipate, just sitting quietly in your living room and have this occur. And it's really shaken the community.
He says six local fire departments and other emergency crews responded.
Subsequent to the incident, Dutchess County Emergency Response has been working with the Unionville Fire Department along with the New York State Police and NTSB to conduct now what will be a fairly extensive investigation to identify cause. We are also, the county has also dispatched our mobile intervention team, our mental health first aid staff to provide assistance not only to the family that you know clearly is now living with significant loss, but to the responders and also neighbors. Several neighbors acted heroically, responding and assisting. In fact, in helping people evacuate the scene. All of that is a form of trauma that individuals are going to need some assistance with, and we're going to stand with them for the duration.
He says there will be a meeting in the coming weeks to help the community.
We're going to hold an informational session or meeting with the community in the coming weeks to try to provide what answers the appropriate agencies can. Our mental health staff is going to be available as well to talk a little bit about how individuals and then how we as a society or community need to respond to trauma.
The Federal Aviation Administration said the Cessna left Skyacres Airport in LaGrangeville, a mile from the crash, and was headed to Republic Airport on East Farmingdale, Long Island. State Police Captain Paul DeCorto said at a news conference that the plane first took off from the Orange County Airport in Montgomery, then stopped to refuel at Skyacres before continuing toward Long Island. DeCorto said the Cessna 303 had some kind of engine trouble before it struck the side of the two-story house. Dutchess County has seen a number of aviation tragedies recently. In June, helicopter pilot Tim McCormick of Clinton Corners was killed when his helicopter crashed on the roof of a Midtown Manhattan skyscraper amid inclement weather.
Certainly, Tim McCormick's crash was unique in and of itself in the city, but Dutchess County as a community now has actually experienced four aviation-related tragedies. And in the last 40 days, and quite frankly, or 60 days, and quite frankly, it's not something that you can or would expect, all of different magnitude.
Reporting from WAMC's Hudson Valley Bureau on the campus of Vassar College, I'm Hudson Valley Bureau Chief Allison Dunn.
Well, after economic development corruption scandals, New York Governor Andrew Cuomo and State Comptroller Tom DiNapoli have finalized a plan to restore the comptroller's auditing powers over economic development contracts. Capitol correspondent Karen DeWitt reports.
Back in 2011, Cuomo persuaded the legislature to agree to limit the comptroller's oversight ability for some economic development projects. They included the $750 million subsidy for the Solar City project that was part of an initiative Cuomo called the Buffalo Billion. At the time, Cuomo said the additional oversight slowed down the bidding and construction process. Since then, bid rigging and bribery scandals related to the Buffalo Billion, as well as other economic development contracts, led to federal corruption charges and prison terms for several of Cuomo's former associates, including his former closest aide, Joe Percoco. The former head of the state university's Polytechnic Institute, Elaine Calieros, who helped cut the deals for many of the contracts, is also facing a jail term, though he's currently free while appealing his conviction. Last March, Cuomo and DiNapoli struck a verbal agreement to reinstate the comptroller's audit powers over the projects. But the actual details of the agreement languished, according to DiNapoli, who spoke about it in late July in an interview with Public Radio.
The spirit is there, but the actual translating the intent into a practice has not happened.
Government reform groups complained that the governor was dragging his feet in setting up the arrangements, something Cuomo's office denied. Late on a Friday afternoon in the middle of August, the governor and controller finally issued a joint memo of understanding. It restores the controller's oversight authority beginning on September 15th. John Caney with the government reform group Reinvent Albany says that's good news.
It clearly is a step forward, increases accountability and decreases corruption risk.
The agreement also provides an additional layer of oversight. The State Inspector General's office, which is part of Cuomo's administration, will have the authority to review the controller's audits. Caney says the more oversight, the better, and he says the IG's new powers will improve transparency. But he says the Inspector General won't have equal powers with the controller when it comes to the contracts.
The Inspector General doesn't get to approve them. They just get to see them in their entirety. That's different from what the comptroller is able to do, which is actually to reject contracts that they think are tainted or don't meet state requirements.
Caney says ultimately, though, the governor and legislature need to pass a law to restore the oversight powers. Governor Cuomo did not comment about the finalized agreement. A spokesman for the controller said in a statement that it's an important step forward in enhancing accountability in state contracting. In Albany, I'm Karen DeWitt.
MGM Springfield is preparing to observe the one-year anniversary of the opening of the first resort casino in Massachusetts. We get that story from WAMC's Pioneer Valley Bureau Chief Paul Tuthill.
1 year ago this Saturday, the $960 million MGM Casino in downtown Springfield opened its doors to the public with great fanfare and high hopes that it would be a catalyst to revitalize the city. During its first year, the resort complex, which includes a gambling floor, 250-room hotel, several restaurants and bars, a movie theater, bowling alley, and comedy club, attracted 6 million visitors, according to MGM Springfield President Mike Mathis, who declared during a press conference Monday that the casino has provided a lift to the local economy.
We're proud of the economic boom that the city's undergoing.
Mathis pointed to higher tax revenue collected by the city from restaurants and hotels as evidence of the casino's impact on tourism, and pointed to new projects recently launched downtown, such as the $40 million redevelopment of the Paramount Theater. Meanwhile, he said consequences predicted by casino detractors have not come to pass.
A lot of the fears that people had about what this would do, it would congest the downtown, you know, whatever the issues were around the perception of crime, they just haven't come to fruition.
The MGM Casino will come up well short of the $418 million in gross gaming revenue it projected in its license application would be taken in from the slot machines and gaming tables in its first year. In the first 11 months, MGM's gross gaming revenue totaled just $253 million, according to the Massachusetts Gaming Commission. Now facing more competition from the newly opened Encore Boston Harbor Casino, Mathis brushed aside concerns that an oversaturated gambling market in the Northeast might prevent MGM from hitting its revenue goal.
I think they are realistic. It's just a matter of when we're going to be able to get there. And that is going to take some time. So if you look at any other facilities in the market, there's always a ramp up.
MGM is opening a new VIP lounge in the Springfield Casino to cater to high rollers and making some other changes to boost its gambling business.
Our slot revenue is starting to stabilize and grow. And, you know, that's really an important aspect of the business. The table games is going to be a little bit more volatile. You really want to grow that steady slot business. And that's something our team's really focused on. So we're pretty excited about where we're at.
Massachusetts collects a 25% tax on the casino's gross gaming revenue. Casinos were pitched to Massachusetts voters in 2014 as job generators. MGM officials repeatedly touted 3,000 jobs would be produced at the Springfield Casino. Current employment is about 2,300, according to Mathis.
These are 2,300 great jobs, well-paying with benefits, and we're launching careers. Sure, we'd love the number to be higher because it would be a reflection that the business is higher. And, you know, that will come with time.
Mathis said he's proud that Springfield residents make up 40% of the workforce, exceeding a local employment goal of 35%. Asked earlier this year about MGM falling short of its job creation promises, Springfield Mayor Dominic Sarno said he expects the company to satisfy its obligations.
In essence, they're still ramping up with the jobs there. The point is we have an agreement, and we're going to make sure that they live up to those agreements moving forward.
To mark the one-year anniversary this Saturday, MGM is planning a public celebration on the outdoor plaza with the New England Patriots cheerleaders, food trucks, and a five-tier birthday cake. Reporting from Springfield, this is Paul Tuthill at WAMC's Pioneer Valley News Bureau on the campus of Western New England University.
And that does it for this episode of the WAMC News Podcast. Stay subscribed for the latest from the Northeast. Till next time, I'm Ian Pickus.